Welcome to the Whole Scoop. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Whole Scoop. This is a health and wellness radio show, and our guests are always highly credentialed in their fields. The goal of this program is to present different and sometimes opposite perspectives to allow the listeners to make informed decisions about what might be the right health approach for them. I am your host, Carol Ferraci, a registered licensed dietitian who has practiced for over 30 years. I'm also the founder of NaturallyNutritionInc.com. You can find me at www.naturallynutritioninc.com. As a healthcare practitioner, it's real important for me to provide you highly qualified guests on a variety of topics in order to promote your own health and wellness. Tonight's show is, you think you have Lyme disease, now what? It's really not that easy. If you think you were ticked off during our last show, trust me, this show is really going to tick you off. The call-in number tonight is 347-855-8894. And you can also direct questions and comments to www.blogtalkradio.com/thewholescoop. Remember to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Blog Talk Radio. We will be taking questions later in the show, and at that time, I'll call out the last four digits of your telephone number. And remember, if you're calling in with a question, please remember to press 1 to become part of the queue for questions. We have wonderful guests tonight. If you remember from our last show, one of our fabulous guests was Susan R. Green. She's the owner of the law offices of Susan Green. And in 2008, she became interested in legal matters arising out of Lyme disease. Her family, having been impacted by Lyme, Ms. Green commenced representing physicians whose licenses were under attack for prescribing long-term antibiotics to Lyme patients. Additionally, she became interested in litigation arising out of the refusal of insurance companies to reimburse physicians for long-term antibiotic treatments. In 2010, Ms. Green authored what would serve to be the foundation and ultimately became Virginia Bill HB 1933, the Lyme Patient Information Disclosure Bill. This bill requires physicians in Virginia to advise patients of the inaccuracy of the two-tier antibody test currently being used by most commercial labs. It further requires doctors to advise patients that a negative test does not mean that a patient does not have Lyme. You can find Susan at www.hardball-law.com. With joining Susan tonight, we have Monty Skull, who is the Executive Director of the National Capital Lyme and Tick-Borne Disease Association, NatCapLyme, a nonprofit organization dedicated to Lyme and tick-borne education, prevention, research, and patient support. This organization has grown to include chapters throughout Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina, and the District of Columbia. Monty has testified, lobbied, and educated at all governmental levels about Lyme and tick-borne diseases. She was the key organizer of an educational briefing and information program for the U.S. Congress that included all 535 congressional offices. You can find Monty at www.natcaplyme.org, and they have a special call-in number at 703-821-8833. With that, let's say hello to our guests. Hello, Monty.
Hi.
And Susan. Hi.
Hello.
Susan?
How are you?
Thank you so much for joining us. This is we have so much to talk about tonight. I thought we had a lot to talk about for our last show, Susan. I know we have things to talk about tonight. And this, I believe, is this is absolutely the concept of how you got involved with this. And if I'm putting words in your mouth, I'm sure you're going to correct me. So, but I have to say that what I've found with this particular topic, now you have Lyme disease, now what do you do? I mean, there are all kind of nuances attached to this. If I am a newly diagnosed Lyme patient, I from what I could tell, I'm going to run into insurance conflicts, maybe physician conflicts, maybe duration of disease thought processes as it relates to physicians. I mean, where does it start? Where does it end? And what do I do if I'm a newly diagnosed Lyme patient?
Well, I would take you back a step and tell you that before you even get to what do I do once I'm diagnosed, the harder part of the whole formula is getting diagnosed. And the reason that's so difficult is, as you spoke briefly in the introduction, the hardest part is getting diagnosed because the tests that currently exist, the commercial laboratory tests, are not very sensitive, and therefore they yield about a 60% false negative rate. So an early infection, 60% of the time, actually over 60% of the time, when your doctor tells you that you don't have Lyme, your test came back negative, you may very well have it. And once you're told you don't have it, you stop looking for it because you're reassured and you think, wow, I dodged that bullet. And you're off looking for other answers. And so as your symptoms progress, and they do progress because the spirochete will continue to replicate and it'll continue to burrow into different organs, and as your, when it involves your central nervous system or your joints and your muscles, you're going to go from doctor to doctor. And, of course, you're not thinking Lyme anymore because you've been told you don't have that. And so now you get diagnoses like, well, you probably have fibromyalgia because you're in so much pain. And you, or you go to the doctor and you say, I'm fatigued all the time. And now you've got a diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome. And then when it starts to affect your central nervous system and suddenly you're getting muscle twitches and having muscle weakness, now you might get a diagnosis like MS or ALS or Parkinson's. And a lot of times the doctors will say to you, you have an imperfect case of one of those diseases because you won't square up, you know, on all fours with that particular illness, but they don't know what else it is, and it looks so much like those diseases. And that's why they call Lyme the great imitator or mimicker. And so now you're off getting treatment for any one of these other diseases when, in fact, all along your Lyme is getting progressively worse. So to get the diagnosis oftentimes is the hardest part. And then once you get the diagnosis and you're relieved because you finally know what's making you so ill, that's the beginning of a whole other journey that's probably equally as challenging.
Wow. Wow. Where do we, there are so many things that we could pick apart with that. Monty, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I confirm what Susan is saying. You know, when we had a task force here in Virginia a couple years ago, I had the opportunity to sit on it and travel around the state and listen in the major cities that we visited and had these town hall meetings to listen to patients who said exactly that. They had trouble getting the initial diagnosis. So I agree. The stories we heard over and over again was, I had a tick bite or I had a bullseye rash. I went in, my doctor pulled the blood, and it came back negative, and he told me I didn't have Lyme disease, I had something else. So these patients go through an average of, I'd say in our support groups, we see people that have seen anywhere from 5 to 10 doctors trying to get a diagnosis. And then usually a year later, they will test positive. They happen to get a test done because they're still having all sorts of physical problems, and somebody does rerun a test on them. But by that time, they've missed a very important window of treatment time. And that is the first thing. The first thing you run into is diagnosis. That's your big problem. The second will be treatment. And what treatment do you get? And as you know, we have two standards of care now. You've got the ILADS and you've got the IDSA. And that's where the big battle begins. So it's hard on a patient. When the patients come to us, they're pretty worn down. They're pretty devastated. And that's why we try to get out there and educate as much as we can to prevent this from happening.
And just so you know, Carol, the IDSA versus the ILADS, IDSA is the Infectious Disease Society of America. Their theory, they believe that Lyme is hard to catch, easy to cure, 28 days worth of antibiotics, and you're better. And they do not embrace the idea of persistent Lyme or chronic Lyme. And they are very rigid in their position. And ILADS, of course, there's a host of science and peer-reviewed literature that's emerging that is demonstrating that the bacteria can persist following antibiotic treatment. And they believe, the people of ILAD, International Lyme Associated Disease Society, believe that depending on the individual, oftentimes a long-term antibiotic protocol is necessary in order to address a later stage Lyme. And the two standards of care, the two groups, are diametrically opposed. There is tremendous infighting between the two groups. And because of that, it is very hard for patients to find good providers and to get coverage for treatment.
And which one of those two groups, in terms of the course of treatment, do insurance companies tend to side with?
Well, of course, it's the IDSA. It's the Infectious Disease Society, because
it's short of 28 days.
Uh-huh. It's 2 weeks to 28 days. It's cheaper for the insurance company to cover that care than it is to cover long-term care.
Okay. Let me ask a question, ladies. Both of you can attest to the persistent long-term ABT or antibiotic therapy in terms of you've seen it over and over again in being necessary, correct? That is correct, right?
Yes.
Okay. And
I don't think I'd be talking to you but for long-term antibiotic treatment.
Okay.
Well, it depends on what you. You've got to define what long-term antibiotic treatment is.
Well, longer than the 28 days, and as much as 2 years, correct? I mean, I'm just going with what I've seen as I've kind of picked up on this whole topic. So my question is this, because you kind of hit it before, Monty, when you said there's a window of treatment. Is it possible, let's just say, like, for someone as we're trying to get the word out and educate people on this particular topic, you know, what if somebody's listening and they say, hey, you know, I've had these chronic situations for a whole long time. I'm having trouble. My doctor just said I have Parkinsonism. I've had MS, and if I remember correctly, Dr. Shor in our last show said that they've had people with MS symptoms that have completely cleared with the long-term treatment. Is it possible, like, say they've had these things for years? Have you seen that? I mean, I guess I'm looking for a little bit of hope from people if they're listening to this going, but I've had this for so long, I doubt anybody can help me. Is that, what have you seen as it relates to that kind of thing? And is that on par for the kinds of things that you're talking about as it relates to the long-term antibiotics? And if so, where do the insurance companies come in? Because then, you know, we're looking at serious illnesses or potential illnesses with diagnoses, and people say, hey, or the insurance companies say, you have that diagnosis and that's not a standard course of treatment. So I'm sure it gets pretty complicated.
It does get complicated, Carol. You know, you said something there that really caught my attention there. You know, when people come to us, what we see are people that have gone down this road, have tried and done everything, and one of our biggest things is, how do we restore hope to those people? Hope is really, really important in the healing process. And a lot of these people have given up hope. And so what you're asking me, everybody's different. I've seen people recover that were in wheelchairs. On the other hand, I've seen people that will take long-term antibiotics and nothing changes for them. So I am not a doctor, so I can't, you know, really answer that question from a medical point of view. Who has those kinds of stats would be the doctors that treat these diseases, these tick-borne diseases. And those, of course, are the Lyme-littered physicians. And I wish that they would start putting these stats out so we could see what their recovery rates are. Are they 60%? Are they 50%? Are they 80%? What did Shor say? Did you ask him that question? Did you ask him that question? How many patients does he see that recovers from, you know, a chronic Lyme situation or a person that's had it for more than, let's say, 2 or 3 weeks? What's his recovery rate like? What does he see? I think we got to start getting this information from doctors and publishing it. And you know, data collection of these cases.
And isn't it going to be difficult to get that information if most physicians don't recognize this, or they're looking at other diagnoses and not even recognizing that it could be Lyme? And then when they finally do get the Lyme, I mean, the linear approach of from where they came, it can be skewed. Is that correct?
That's why it really has to come from a lot of these, I hate to use the word, Lyme treating physicians. You know, you have doctors out there that have been treating tick-borne diseases for 25, 30 years. So think about that. Think about how many patients they've seen. I mean, I've had this disease since 1991. And I remember I was treated up in New York State by a very well-known doctor. And so, what is that, about 25 years right there?
Yeah.
So I can tell you, Carol, from the other side of the other viewpoint is, I represent a lot of doctors who do treat long-term antibiotics, and I can tell you one case in particular comes to mind of a soldier who was disabled. He had a very chronic form of Lyme, and he was wheelchair-bound, couldn't speak. And there was a reporter who said that he contacted me and said, we're going to follow this soldier, and we're going to write a story about his condition now and about this treatment of long-term antibiotics. And I want you to know that when he's finished treating, we're going to report on it, whether it's good or bad. And I said, well, you go ahead and do that. I said, I'm not concerned. And sure enough, he did. He wrote two articles on it. And it was really interesting because here was a guy who had been written off as completely disabled and was about to be separated from the military. By the time he got finished treating with long-term antibiotics, he was about 95% better. And I remember the reporter calling me back. He was blown away. He couldn't believe it. And he thought, when he started the article, he thought that he would be writing a story about what quacks these doctors were. But he was shocked to find that this man had his life restored. And it's not. Mm-hmm. This is not a unique story. Monty can tell you that we see people all the time who, you know, kids who can't see. We see people who are in wheelchairs, can't walk, can't speak, and, you know, with long-term anti. I mean, one of the most well-known stories was in the movie Under Our Skin. Dr. Martz, who was misdiagnosed with ALS, he was sent home to die. And he was treated with IV antibiotics, and he's back to practicing medicine. And so, it's not a coincidence. There are so many people that do recover.
Well, and I think you said something really important there, Susan, and that's that this guy was 95% better. But as these people have dealt with this for years and years, and have gotten absolutely no relief, I mean, there really is no real percentage of quality of life. So if somebody has a 40% improvement, that's huge, you know, for them, that's huge. And then a 95% improvement is just, they're elated, they're just stunned. So, you know, any possible positive effective change in this scenario is good. So that being said, though, let's talk about, I really do want to talk about some of these obstacles, because they're just horrendous obstacles for everybody. And, you know, where Susan, you know probably better than anyone the hoops that physicians have to literally jump through just to maintain. And you've had to actually defend them for trying to take care of their patients, correct?
That's correct. The states vary from state to state in terms of the medical boards that regulate medicine within their states. But most of the medical boards subscribe to the IDSA guidelines, and most of them believe that the quote-unquote standard of care is 28 days of treatment, okay? And these, what they will do is either, a lot of times it's as a result of a complaint from an insurance company, where a patient will go and try to submit reimbursement for long-term antibiotic treatment. And that insurance company will start an investigation with the medical boards. And the medical boards will dig their heels in and only look at the one standard of care, although there are two very clear standard of cares. Even in states where I have seen the adoption of the dual standard of care, oftentimes members of the individual medical boards who are sitting on a particular doctor's case revert back to, oh, the IDSA guidelines are the appropriate guidelines, and we're not going to think outside of that box. And so it makes these doctors, you know, subject to constant scrutiny. And there's such a body of science that has emerged since the original guidelines were adopted. And, you know, even in the last, you know, couple of years since they were refiled, there's such a body of science emerging that's demonstrating that there's a couple things that that is becoming more apparent. One thing is that it's no longer, Lyme is no longer just Lyme. Oftentimes, it is an aggregate group of infections, co-infections such as Babesia, Bartonella, or Ehrlichiosis, and there's a host of co-infections that are often transmitted with a tick bite besides Lyme. And then on top of that, your immune system plays a big role in how you're going to manifest the symptoms of Lyme. And so you may have a multi-organism infection and a compromised immune system that takes you outside of the quote-unquote IDSA standard of care.
So you may develop like diabetes or something. Is that where you're going? Like something that's a little more common, you might develop something else that takes you into a different realm, and that then causes confusion? I didn't mean to cut you short there. I was just
Oh, that's okay.
Thinking.
No, I'm speaking more to the fact that you know, we don't generally refer to Lyme as just plain Lyme anymore, because we refer to it as tick-borne disease, because oftentimes when you get bitten by the tick, there's so many other infections and so many other parasites that come with it that, you know, you may have a whole host of other symptoms that need treating besides just the Lyme. And when you get those co-infections, it makes the Lyme even more resistant to treatment, you know. So each individual, there's no silver bullet for this disease, but each individual needs to be tested for the whole gamut of infections and parasites that they may have acquired as a result of a tick bite. And then on top of that, one has to look at their immune system. Is there, you know, do they already have issues? For instance, you see a lot of patients with Crohn's disease. And, you know, as you know, the gut is the brains of the immune system. If you have a gut that's not working, your immune system's not working. So how are you ever going to clear an infection?
We could talk about, and I guess that's where I was going when I said diabetes, because you could talk about Crohn's disease, you can talk about celiac disease, you can talk about, and when I say diabetes, then I'm looking at a compromised immune system as well that could have been as a direct result of all these underlying issues. And so now you're talking about peeling away an onion, and that's kind of like an analogy that I use with some clients. Because you have to go through layers and layers to get to the root cause of what's happening and then deal with that issue. And if that's the case, then I go back to Monty's scenario where she said there's a window of opportunity, or there's a window of treatment for appropriate opportunities with this. And if that happens, then when you get to the onion peeling phase, you're really having to work backwards. And so do you have the energy? Do you have the desire? Do you have the strength? And then on top of that, do you have the right doctor? And is it being handled appropriately? So there's a lot of mental anguish that's attached with this.
Right, the patient's got to be on top of everything, and that's really sad, because a lot of the people, by the time they're seen, they're really compromised, and those things aren't there, Carol. The energy's not there. The, you know, the cognitive alertness of what they need to be doing. I want to insert something in here. I think it's important with what Susan is saying. One of the things that we're starting to do now is to make sure people understand the importance of testing their tick. And because she mentioned all the co-infections that can go along and the viruses that we're seeing now. And we encourage people, and we try to get out through our education, keep that tick, you know, have it tested, not only for a couple of co-infections, but I think our new brochure is coming out, and we have 18 different infections and viruses in there that you can be testing for now. What we used to see in the 90s, and I think I mentioned this to you before, was people would go and they would get a tick bite, they would start to get treatment. Maybe a year on down the line, they remembered the tick bite and they were having symptoms. And so they would start getting treatment. They would treat for maybe 3 months. They would feel a lot better and they'd get off treatment. And then 6 months later, they were right back where they started from. They relapsed. And we found out later on that some of these people had co-infections, but nobody back in the 90s really tested much for co-infections. If you have that tick, you now, and have had it tested, you now know what was in that tick that bit you. So after you go through your treatment, if you do relapse, you can be using the appropriate drugs to treat yourself again. So we think that's really important, tick testing.
Yeah, that's a great point. Thank you. We do have a question on the blog, so let me just interject this particular question because it falls right in line with what we're talking about, okay? It says, can I have Lyme if I never found a tick? My doctor says I have Parkinsonism. Should I ask about Lyme disease?
Go ahead, Susan.
Well, I would just say that first of all, the ticks are so tiny that they're very, very easily missed. And people get bullseye rashes in less than 50% of the cases. And so the fact that you didn't see the tick or you didn't have a bullseye rash really is meaningless. First of all, I would urge everybody to get tested to Lyme with their annual physical. I mean, what is the harm? It is such a pandemic. We are sitting on the wave of a pandemic. And so it's a simple blood test. It's not reliable. If you have symptoms and you're not sure that you have Parkinson's, I wouldn't instruct you to not take your doctor's advice. Your doctor, of course, is your physician. I don't practice medicine, but I would absolutely urge anybody who has ALS, Parkinson's, or MS, and who is not really, you know, sure that they have it. Tell you, get tested.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This one says Parkinsonism, which would fall right in line with what you just said.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is kind of a catch-all for symptoms like Parkinson's, but not really Parkinson's.
You know, Parkinson-like symptoms can be caused from drug and we're not doctors here, okay? I want to make that clear.
No, and I know that. I get that.
I've done enough reading on drug side effects. And Parkinsonism-like effects can be gotten from numerous types of drugs. You've got to do your due diligence here, and when you do go on treatment, you've got to research what you're putting into your body. That is so very, very important. And you know, Parkinson-like syndrome is usually brought on by certain types of drugs, and it will go away if you remove the drug a lot of times. Not every time, but I've read enough about it that does happen.
Okay. Well, and that's a good question. And I kind of like the idea that people need to understand and know that you may have been bitten by a tick, and if you don't have the tick, it doesn't mean you weren't bitten by one. I think that's an important point to make because they can also just get full and fall off, right? I mean, not everybody finds a tick. Is that?
Well, they can be in your scalp. They can be behind your knee. They could be in a place that you're not going to see them. So, and I hear that a lot. People say to me that they just, it was, you know, on their back or whatever, and sometimes a spouse will find them, or in your hair. And so because of that, you know, you shouldn't rely on the fact that just because you didn't see the tick, you don't have it. The other thing I hear all the time is I see people with classic bullseye rashes go to their doctors and they're told that's a spider bite or that's ringworm. And so, you know, there's a lot of misdiagnosis in that manner as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That says a lot right there in terms of where the kinds of things. And I think you guys made the point, and you made it very well, in that we are in charge of our own health care, and we have to do the due diligence for finding out what's wrong with us. And,
you know,
and if we – go ahead, please.
Carol, I'll never forget the story of this guy that called – this gentleman that called me up. This was about maybe 10 years ago. And he had Parkinson's, and he had tremors. And why I remember him, because he was driving into D.C., because he had to work. He had to be able to make a living. And the only way he could keep from shaking was holding on to the steering wheel. Well, the whole picture in my mind of this whole thing was so scary to me in rush hour traffic with this poor gentleman holding on to this wheel. But, you know, we sat down. I got together with him, and I took his medical history because it's very – he had no neurological disease in his family history. And anyway, we went back, and he told me that he was on a drug for depression, and he had been treated with that drug for about 3 years. And he said that's sort of when the tremoring started. So I said, that's interesting. So I went back, and I have a PDF reference for maybe 15 years of them. They put them out every year. Physicians use them. And I went back and found the drug. And sure enough, it was Parkinson-like syndrome that you could get from the drug. And if you got off the drug, your recovery was not guaranteed, but you had a chance that the symptoms would dissipate or go away. And we pinned it back to that drug. That drug was pulled off the market. It was only on the market for 5 years. And unfortunately, he had taken it for 3. And I don't know what happened to the gentleman, but I know that he felt that he had found out something that he had no idea of, that another drug could cause him to experience what he was experiencing with
Interesting.
Parkinson's.
Let me just stop for just a second and remind everybody that you're listening to the Whole Scoop Radio Show on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Carol Ferraci, licensed registered dietitian and founder of Naturally Nutrition, Inc., and you can check me out at www.naturallynutritioninc.com. Tonight's show is You Think You Have Lyme Disease, Now What? We're talking with Susan Green, owner of Susan R. Green Law Offices, and you can find Susan at www.hardball-law.com. And Monty Skull, the executive director of National Capital Lyme and Tick-Borne Disease Association. You can find her at www.natcaplyme.org. And Monty, do you want to give that phone number real fast?
Mm-hmm. Our hotline is 703-821-8833.
All right, thanks. Remember, everybody, we're going to be taking some more questions in just a few minutes. Also, remember to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Blog Talk Radio. So, yeah, Monty, I think that's an excellent point, but it also goes back to, Susan, where you're dealing with the doctors that diagnose with Lyme, correct? You are dealing with the Lyme doctors.
Yes, I represent a number of Lyme-literate medical doctors, yes.
Okay. So your experiences are a little different in that you are dealing directly with those particular physicians that are obviously open to the possibility of Lyme, and so they have a tendency to see things a little differently. But what about those doctors out there that aren't as well versed, and how do people find these Lyme doctors? How do they find the right person in which to go?
Well, if you're looking for a doctor who treats Lyme on a frequent basis, you can go to International Lyme and Associated Disease Society, or ILADS, and they can always make a referral. Or you can go to NatCap, Lyme also can help you find doctors in your area. The doctors who do not, who are not, who have not made a discipline out of really immersing themselves, if you will, in the emerging body of medicine regarding Lyme disease, some of them, some of what mainstream medicine does today is very alarming to me. I speak to people on a daily basis. People call me. Some of them call me because they want to bring a misdiagnosis case. Some of them just call me because they've heard about me and they want to get a consultation about, you know, what should they do in their situation. And, you know, recently there was a person who had contacted me from Maryland area close to Virginia, and I could tell from her symptoms that she needed to be tested for Lyme and associated diseases. But of particular interest to me was that she was having serious night sweats and some other symptoms that made me wonder if she had been exposed to Babesia. And I said to her, you know, you should go to your doctor, ask him for a Lyme test and associated tests for Babesia, Bartonella, ehrlichiosis, and everything, every co-infection that is in Maryland, just to rule it out, because her symptoms were just so diverse and so many of them were symptoms that a person with Lyme and associated infections might have. She went to three different doctors in the area and asked for a test for Babesia. And she was told by three different mainstream doctors that we don't have Babesia in this country, and that even it's a third world country disease, and even if we had it, they wouldn't know how to treat it. Okay, that's a really alarming statement, because the Red Cross about a year ago, or maybe it's 2 years ago now, came out with an alert indicating that the blood banks are tainted with Babesia. So if we don't have it here, how did our blood banks get tainted with Babesia? Furthermore, a doctor in the Montgomery County area in Maryland had done a tick drag in the not-so-distant past, and that tick drag, when he collected ticks and tested them, Babesia was outperforming Lyme in that area. So here is an area with three different physicians who didn't even know about the disease Babesia and didn't even know that it existed in this country, much less their state. And they were turning away patients, telling them that we don't have that here. So it's very difficult for a patient trying to find their way through the system. How do I find a doctor who is, A, open-minded enough to, aware enough to test me for the things I need to be tested for, aware enough to know that the tests can yield false negatives, okay, and are knowledgeable enough about the symptoms that they would recognize the illness as in a clinical diagnosis and treat, even if the blood test didn't confirm the disease. Because, after all, it is a clinical diagnosis. The tests are just so substandard that if you wait for the test to turn positive, they may never turn positive, the test, some people.
Well, and that makes sense, though, now that, as you've described it, as both of you have talked about the myriad of issues and diseases that are attached to this, the testing that we have, just, I think you hit the nail on the head, maybe, Monty, with testing the tick, because if you test the tick, then, you can certainly come in a different way and treat a different way. So,
We've had this discourse with the CDC some time about, because they don't believe in tick testing, because they feel that you don't know whether the actual organism from the tick passed from the tick to the host, which would be, the human. But we've always said, just have that information, for the future, or even for the present, to us is so important if you have symptoms. So hopefully they're going to be changing their stance on that, we hope, because we just think it's really so important to get that across to people. You don't know how many times, Carol, people have told me they've taken the tick off and flushed it down the toilet. If I hear that once in a week, I must hear that 20 times. And, that's one of the things, the whole preconception about tick-borne diseases. For years, you know, back in the 50s and the 60s, nobody paid much attention to ticks. And the fact that I've had people come up to me and say, oh, Monty, I was covered with ticks. You know, I'm a farmer. I used to work out in the fields when I was younger. They didn't think anything of it. So almost in a way, some, as far as, you know, getting the ideas across, one of them is, you know, this is something to be concerned about, tick-borne diseases. It's not something that you discount if you have a tick attachment.
Well, you know what, Monty? I mean, your organization focuses on that education, right?
Right.
And what is it that you're doing, and how, I mean, how far-reached are you for education? Because, you know, Susan, on our last show, we talked about how some physicians don't think that the state of Florida has Lyme disease, which just amazed me. And so that education is just critical, and it's critical for everywhere. So what kinds of things are you doing, and where?
Well,
what should we be looking for?
Well, we spend a lot of time doing public outreach. We have, I think, one of the finest lines of literature out there. We make it free to the public. We have 6 brochures, a tick card, and posters, and we try to get them out to health departments throughout, you know, as many states as we can. We do probably 25 different events a year, education events. We do HHS. We just did them last week for all their employees, something like 500 employees come through. We're doing Homeland Security. We're doing Department of Agriculture, Department of Education. So that's a very big, important thing to our organization, especially because of the area that we live in here in the Washington, D.C. area. The other thing we're doing I'm really excited about, we're funding a educational curriculum because we believe in education from the bottom up, and that is a curriculum that will be kindergarten through 12th grade, and it will have lesson plans. It will be it's teachable. It's ready to go. It meets the core curriculum for the state of Virginia and also for the state of Maryland, and it will be made available for different states
you know,
to meet their core curriculum, because each state is different with their requirements.
Well, that's great. People go to your website.
Yes, I used to teach myself, and what I would remember, especially grades, first grade through, about fourth grade, kids would love to go home and teach their parents what they learned that day. So,
yes.
So we're really excited about this concept, and we hope
right.
it takes off. There's not a website up yet. It's being done by a doctor of education, Dr. Nancy Fox, and I think it's 8 other teachers from high school down through kindergarten that have committed to creating this curriculum for us.
Perfect.
So
great.
These are some of the things that we're doing as far as education is concerned this year.
Well, that's great, and I think it's real important that people visit your website and find out what that's about so they can get in on that education, because obviously again, we're just scratching the surface on this thing. And, you know, Susan, I was amazed when you said that they didn't think that we had Lyme in Florida, and that research shows that it's actually a mecca for Lyme, and it's amazing. So I think that is part of it, because that's a big, huge part of it, because we meaning I'm in Florida, and we're going to get those physicians saying, oh, no, we don't have that here. So that's critical. But
I
we
still
do
remember
have a couple
Christmas.
Of
Christmas,
I'm
the
sorry?
Palm Beach Post. I still remember Christmas, the Palm Beach Post, saying that there was an outbreak of Babesia in Palm Beach, and they said but they knew that the snowbirds had to have brought it down through blood transfusions, because they had ticks in Florida, but their ticks don't bite people. They've got vegan ticks.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
You know, Carol,
yeah.
Something you all might think of down there is we did this in Virginia. They were telling us the same thing. The southern part of Virginia, there was no Lyme disease. Even though, you know, people were getting positive tests, you don't have Lyme disease down there. So what we did was we were very fortunate in that we had a woman who belonged to our group that ran, or she still runs, a dog grooming business, and she would be collecting these ticks off the dogs as they came in, and she started to notice that the owners of the dogs were bringing in positive Lyme tests. So she started to work with our local veterinarian school down there, our university, VPI, and they started doing tick drags. And they start, because she knew where the infestation rates were the highest, because she knew where the dogs were coming with from with the ticks. And
right.
So she ended up probably doing one of the most exciting studies that I think they presented it last year in Chicago at the National Veterinarians Association conference. They came out with it originally was a 52% infection rate of Lyme disease, and when they had done all the things that they do to weed out other things that would cause positive tests, they came down to, I think it was 36.7 infection rate, and that is huge. And that's when, and they did it through the University of Oklahoma, that has one of the finest research centers in the country. Nobody, will fight with the results that come out of there. So the CDC came in on this, picked it up, and published this study. And now there is no dispute that most of all of Virginia has Lyme disease, all regions of Virginia. So it's something you might think about doing in Florida.
You got it. Listen, we've got a couple of questions. We're gonna open this up for a minute, okay? All right. Caller 0958, you have a question?
Hi, yes, good evening. This is a very exciting and interesting show. I'm so glad, Susan, that you're on. I have a question. I was privileged enough to look over a copy of a medical research paper entitled Advanced Topics on Lyme Disease by Dr. Joseph Burascano. And I really enjoyed what he said and how he said it. He made it very simple so that everyone could understand it. But there was something I had a question on. He believes, and he states in his paper, that Lyme disease symptoms can totally and completely be eradicated and reversed if you use his plan. And he states, and he uses the word, that this is an absolute. And it's very easy to follow. He just says you can't get behind in your sleep, you can't have a caffeine or stimulant, no alcohol at all, no smoking, you can't have simple carbs, and you absolutely, positively have to be in compliance with all the steps above. And I don't know if he's suggesting here that people that continue to have Lyme-associated symptoms have them at their own will because they're simply not complying to his list of absolutes. Can you comment on that?
Susan, you want to comment?
Susan, before you start that, let me just preface this with these ladies are not physicians, so we just want to make sure that everybody understands that. So, Susan, go for it.
Okay, so I'm going to start with all the disclaimers I need to put out there, which is I'm not sure that I've read exactly what you're referring to, number one. Number two, as I indicated, I'm not a physician, but here's what I would tell you. What I would tell you is the following. Again, each individual has within their system a host of infections, co-infections. They have different immune system compromises. They might be vitamin deficient. They might be have a leaky gut so that they can't absorb nutrition properly. There can be a host of circumstances that create the soup of the individual. And so, for me, absolutes are always very frightening. And I think that each person has to be viewed on a case-by-case basis, and I think that there has to be a total analysis of their health, their weaknesses, their infections, and then and only then can a protocol be created for that particular individual. I see people share protocols on the internet all the time. Dr. So-and-so put me on this. For me, it's horrifying because someone else may look at that protocol and go, gee, so-and-so is getting better, and she or he's taking da-da-da-da, if I take that, I'll get better too. Well, you may not have the same set of circumstances, nor may your body be able to take and utilize that protocol for whatever reason. So I would emphasize it's individualized for each person. Now, basics, nutrition, rest, okay, are these things that everybody has to have in order to get better? Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, fundamentally for the body to thrive, for the body to be able to fight off infection, rest is important. I think every doctor will tell you that. And I think nutrition is really important. I know that most of the Lyme treating doctors would tell you to get away from gluten, but I do know people that are able to tolerate it. So it's very individualized, but I always shy away from absolutes.
This is not really like an umbrella cure like it would appear to be in the listing that's offered in that paper, so that everyone really has to look at their own situation and what their own symptoms that have come to light are and treat it that way?
You know, again, I think that I have the utmost respect for Dr. Beriscano, but I think that, you know, if you have Lyme, you know, do you also have Babesia? If you have Babesia, you'll need an anti-malarial. Do you have any parasites? What's going on in your body? So to speak to Lyme and say that there's this silver bullet cure, I will simply say I think that there's just not enough information to make that kind of blanket statement, but that's just my opinion.
Well, and I think that kind of goes back to, you know, the patient has to be very astute. So, hey, thank you very much for calling in, and we've got another question. So, thank you. And
thank you.
Hold on. 6297, you have a question?
Yes, thank you so much, and I, too, am enjoying, I can say enjoy because I'm very upset with the statistics you've been saying. So I'm going back to the beginning of the show when you were saying, both of you were saying about, I think it was 60% of positive Lyme are turning up negative. So what happens, I still go back to what to do at that point. What do you do then? Do you start then having to go through the gamut of MS testing and Parkinson's, or do you think the doctor, no, I had a bullseye, treat me for Lyme anyway, or tick-borne?
They didn't have a lethal definition, so they're not in total compliance. I'm like, what?
We've got somebody else on. Hold on a second. I think we fixed that. Sorry about that. Go ahead. Caller 6297. I'm sorry.
Should I start from the beginning? I don't know what you heard. I'm sorry.
Say it again. It got a little confusing with the over voice there.
Okay. So my question is, well, it's actually two parts, but if I, let's say, had a bullseye and the test came back negative for various tick-borne illnesses, so what does someone do? Do you have to go first through testing of other disorders and then go back to for insurance to pay for a test again, or should you really advocate to the doctor and say, no, treat me for Lyme, I had the bullseye, I have, you know, X, Y, and Z symptoms, but then of course long time antibiotics isn't necessarily good either. So I guess one of my questions, and if there's time I have another question. So I guess it goes back to, what does someone do with that if they have a negative test but they still have signs? What can they actually do? What's the best
Well,
next
if
step?
You have a bullseye rash, you mentioned a bullseye rash. If you had a bullseye rash and you got a negative test, you would still qualify for treatment right off the bat because of the bullseye rash. That's number one. Number two, what
I'm
tell
sure
people.
That.
Hello?
I'm sorry.
I'm not sure what that noise is.
Yeah. The other thing, that's why I say tick testing is so important, because if you do have that tick, you can test and see what's in that tick. So that would help you make your decision. It boils down to the fact, if the test is negative, you had a tick attachment, you have the tick tested and the tick is negative, then I would probably say, if it were me, I don't necessarily need to be treated. But if that tick was positive, I would want to be treated. In fact, what I do is go ahead and treat anyway until that test comes back from the tick.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. That may now the next question I have is I am one of those people that live in Florida now, but I did live in the Hudson Valley, and many, many years ago, well, all my kids have gotten, you know, ticks and stuff, but my daughter had a bullseye, and the doctor treated her right away, even if I remember correctly, even before the test came back, because I think it took a while, if I remember correctly. My question is, now that I'm listening to the show, is that now it's at least, oh, I don't know, 15 years later, and she has been misdiagnosed with peripheral neuropathy and different things. So we know what she doesn't have, but we still don't know what she does have. So would, is it possible, because she only had antibiotics for a few weeks, could there be a low level of a tick-borne disease still in her body? Is that something to possibly explore? Would you know that a doctor's question?
How old is your child?
Well, actually, now she's 25, but she was a youngster when this happened many years ago. And she must have been about 10 when that happened.
Well, you know what we do when we have our support groups, and we have a lot of them, people talk and they exchange ideas. And one of the things that I hear a lot is that, you know, sometimes when you get 2 weeks treatment, the first time around, you might not know you had been bit before that or you were exposed before that, and you really have a more advanced form of the disease. So sometimes you might be treating, you know, a more disseminated form of the disease, but you don't realize it. So you need longer treatment. I think if it was my child, I would want to investigate it more now. Yes. I mean, that's my personal opinion, though.
Okay. No, because she's been to the Mayo, you know, clinic, and so I'm listening. I never even thought of the Lyme. I thought of it, you know, years ago, and also because we do live in Florida, I don't naturally think of Lyme disease, so that's an interesting point compared to when I lived in the Hudson Valley. So, okay, I really appreciate
your
insight.
So it's not unusual for children to relapse. It's not unusual.
To relapse. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
And something that could be.
Or it could have been a subsequent bite that she didn't notice, but I would urge you to have her evaluated from that standpoint, just to rule it out. You know,
just to rule out.
Right. The evaluation, you know, or you can. The other thing is, there are a lot of books out there that really go into a detailed list of symptoms. I think one of my favorites is the Lyme Disease Solution by Kenneth Singleton, or Dr. Horowitz's book, Richard Horowitz. You know, if you look at a lot of these books, Verascano's got a list of symptoms. If you look at this list of symptoms and you see, because a lot of times people will have symptoms they don't even associate with the possibility of Lyme disease. And if you look at these symptoms and you see that she's got, you know, more than the ones you even thought about, I would just have her checked out. I think that in this case, with this disease, I think you should always err on the side of caution.
Here's the other thing, Susan, throw in the co-infections. You probably didn't have her tested for co-infections back then, did you?
Oh, I don't believe so. Again, it was at least 15 years ago, if not more. And then probably when she was 16 is when she was diagnosed with peripheral neuropathy, but that diagnosis was just taken away at the Mayo Clinic last fall or last winter, or November. So... But meanwhile,
you know,
she still has these symptoms, and we don't know what's going on.
Another common co-infection that you see with neuropathy is Bartonella. And Bartonella, another word for it, is an explanation of it is cat scratch fever. And cats carry it. So that's something else to think about if peripheral neuropathy is a big issue.
Okay. All right. I appreciate it. Thank you so much, both of you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for calling in. And on that note, we're almost out of time. And I think, Susan, you gave us a name of a physician in Florida. There's only one physician in Florida. Do you want to throw that out again for this caller?
You know, I don't know who I gave in Florida. Oh, no, I was talking about, I think the
fine.
Last time we were talking about Carrie Clark. Carrie Clark is an epidemiologist. He's in northern Florida. Monty, what university is he at? Florida Atlantic?
Florida State.
Carrie Clark is
Florida
an epidemiologist.
Okay.
Or you know what? There are some great Florida advocacy groups that you can get in touch with. If you go on Google Florida Lyme, they'll pop up. You can get in touch with some great leaders down here, and they would be happy to give you names of physicians in the area.
Great.
Melissa Bell's
Thank
group.
You so
what's
much.
Called? What's Melissa's group called, Susan?
Is it Florida Lyme Disease
Association?
I think so.
And they're up. Where are they located?
I'm not sure. I think she's up in Orlando, I believe. And there's Allison Caruana.
Oh yeah, Allison. Good group. Mm-hmm.
She's in Northern Florida as well. She's in Orlando area, and Dolores Clausen. They're all three Lyme advocates in Florida, and all of them could point you in the direction of some good docs.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. On that note, what we're going to do now is say thank you to you ladies. This has been a fabulous show. It has been it's almost exhausting with all the information, and there's just never enough time to decipher all the information. So I can't thank you enough for spending time with us, and I'm not kidding when I say that perhaps we need to re-examine this at a later date and see if we want to narrow the scope a little bit more and talk some more about this if you're interested. So,
okay.
Carol, thank you
that.
For having us. We'll come back anytime you ask us.
That's right.
Thank you so very much. I want to remind everybody that our next show is going to be March 26th. At that time, we're going to be talking about diabetes and what carbohydrates have to do with diabetes, and if and when it's best to restrict those carbohydrates when you've been given a diagnosis of diabetes, and there are times when there's not. And Franziska Spritzler, who's the author of The Low-Carb Dietitian, will be talking with us, along with Lily Nichols, who's the author of Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. So those two ladies have a whole lot to say, too. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Susan and Monty, it's been just fabulous, and I look forward to the next time we talk.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.